Welcome to this special audio supplement to a satellite CME symposium held during the 2018 ASCO annual meeting in Chicago. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with two of the faculty members who participated in this symposium after the meeting, Drs. Axel Grothy and Philip Philip, to discuss their perspectives on the clinical management scenarios presented to the audience and discussed by the faculty, along with questions submitted by the audience members during the meeting. To begin, I chatted with Dr. Grothy, who along with Dr. Scott Kopetz discussed management of metastatic colorectal cancer during this symposium, and Dr. Grothy commented on this question posed to the audience. In recent years, have you observed more patients with colorectal cancer under age 50 coming into your practice? More than two-thirds of the audience said yes, as did Dr. Grothy.
So we have seen actually recent data from the cancer statistics publication that the incidence and mortality of patients over 50 is actually decreasing in colorectal cancer, potentially due to using screening methods, colonoscopies and others, and really detecting polyps and cancers in an early stage. Now, we do not implement screening technologies and screening recommendations yet, and it's just changing actually right now for patients under the age of 50. And so in contrast to the over 50-year-old population, we see an increase, an absolute and relative increase of cases, incidence of mortality in colorectal cancer under the age of 50. Now, I do see that in my clinical practice, but at Mayo Clinic, of course, it's kind of a referral bias. I mean, we see younger patients, and I think the same is true for Scott, for instance, Scott Kopetz at MD Anderson. That is a select patient population, but the overall data statistics that just came out earlier this year clearly indicate there's an increased risk of colorectal cancer for the younger patient population. Still a minority, of course, of all cases in colorectal cancer. The majority of cases is beyond 60 years of age. But I think we have to keep in mind that the lifetime implication of an early diagnosis cancer is potentially stronger than someone who is 85 years old and gets diagnosed with a cancer, because you have more life to lose. And patients who are in the 40s or in their late 30s, they at the very moment they have young families, they are in the work life, the implications for these patients is huge.
What about the pathology or pathophysiology of what's going on? Why is it that we are seeing this incidence? I was doing a symposium recently with your colleagues, Tony Saab and John Marshall, and they were joking around about eat dirt, you know, tell your kids to eat dirt or put their whatever. So obviously, you know, a lot of people are talking about the microbiome. What are your thoughts about what's going on and why we're seeing these cases?
So since we haven't changed genetically, you know, over the, you know, in the last years, something has to do with lifestyle or the kind of host environment interaction. And I do believe that the microbiome, which is affected by what we eat, how we live, is contributing at least to the higher incidence of these cancers in early age. There's a lot of environmental and nutrition factors that we can count on. And if Tony and John say, you know, eat dirt, you know, get a normal flora into your gut, that might actually be true. I don't think we fully understand the implication of widespread use of antibiotics, for instance, in farming, how this affects, you know, how our microbiome, our bacteria in our gut get changed, and how this then influences early onset of colorectal cancer and neoplasia.
So let's go through some of the other questions we asked. We talked a lot, of course, about the management of metastatic disease. And one question we asked the audience was, what do they order in terms of biomarkers, in terms of workup? So in addition to RAS profile, we also asked about HER2, BRAF, and MSI status. What do you consider right now sort of the baseline for any patient with metastatic disease?
Exactly the factors that you said, you know, expanded RAS panel, BRAF, and I would actually look at a next-gen sequencing BRAF analysis, because we now need to distinguish between BRAF V600E and non-V600E mutant tumors. I do believe HER2 is part of the panel because it's a negative predictive marker for EGF receptor antibody therapy, that these data are emerging. And it's a target for interventions in various clinical trials. And then, of course, MSI or mismatch repair deficiency to get patient funneled into immunotherapy.
You said HER2 predicts resistance to EGFR antibodies?
Yeah, so that's an interesting point. When you look at the patients who are HER2 amplified, HER2 overexpressed, those patients are commonly resistant to EGF receptor antibody therapy. Let me give you another example. If you look at the overall incidence of HER2 amplification in colorectal cancer, it's about 2 to 2.5%. Now, if you refine this patient population, you say it's a left-sided tumor, RAS, RAF, wild type, and has not responded to EGF receptor antibody therapy, you go up to about 20%. And there are preclinical and more clinical data now that HER2 amplification is one of the resistance mechanisms to EGF receptor antibody therapy, even in left-sided tumors.
That's interesting. Is there any thought about using anti-HER agents in combination with EGFR antibodies?
I haven't seen any data yet, but it could be interesting to explore that.
As long as you mention HER2, and we'll get into the other issues too, but what are the therapeutic implications? Are you using anti-HER therapy in these patients?
Yes, I mean, we have clinical trials at Mayo Clinic and Sarah Cannon that really target HER2 amplification. And it's really following the guidance of breast cancer. I mean, there are data from an Italian study, trastuzumab, lapatinib, a combination that was tested in the ALTO trial in breast cancer, for instance, high response rate in the range of about 30%, even in heavily pretreated patients. And more importantly, some of the responses are actually long-lasting. And there's the MyPathway study, which looks at combination of trastuzumab, pertuzumab. Herbert's, you know, published or presented some of the data. Again, similar response rate, 35 to 40%, longer lasting. And, you know, this is without chemotherapy. This is just exploiting biology. You use two HER2-targeted agents in a later line setting, and you see durable responses in about 30 to 35% of patients.
So what specifically is a regimen that you have used or would use outside a trial setting?
Yeah, I have used both. I've used trastuzumab, lapatinib, and I've used trastuzumab, pertuzumab. It's very difficult to compare these two right now in terms of anecdotal evidence, which is better. We have evidence and we have safety data for both regimens from the breast cancer world. I mean, these are tolerable regimens. I think right now the breast cancer world and what we're doing in colorectal cancer is more moving toward trastuzumab, pertuzumab. There's an ongoing SWOG study, which is also a registration study in second-line therapy, which actually uses trastuzumab, pertuzumab compared to irinotecan and cetuximab in second-line in HER2-amplified patients.
You know, it's funny because the one thing I didn't hear you say is the most common way it's used in breast cancer, which is chemo plus anti-HER therapy, trastuzumab.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, the SWOG study, for instance, initially had irinotecan as part of the second-line treatment, but I think we want to test biology at first and really get the confounding factor of chemotherapy out of the equation.
So here's a first-line question we asked the audience and got a whole variety of answers, which is a younger patient with a left-sided, microsatellite stable, pan-RAS wild-type, BRAF V600E mutation positive tumor. And the audience, a lot of them would use FOLFOX Bev. Some would use FOLFOX EGFR antibody. A fair number of people use FOLFOX Eri Bev, which is what you and Scott Kopetz picked.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how you factor in BRAF status as well as sidedness?
Okay, so sidedness, of course, tells us something about responsiveness to EGF receptor antibodies and prognosis. We know that left-sided tumors do better than right-sided tumors. And right-sided tumors, even if they are RAS and BRAF wild type, they still do not respond well to EGF receptor antibody, so that the NCCN guidelines actually do not want these patients to be treated right-sided tumors with EGF receptor antibodies, at least not in first-line therapy. Now, in this case here, a BRAF V600E mutant tumor that trumps everything. This makes this cancer very aggressive. And it's actually probably the most aggressive molecular parameter that we have for these patients. So these patients need special attention. That's about 8 to 10% of patients in stage 4. And we have data to suggest that a triplet chemotherapy combination with bevacizumab might actually be the best way to deal with these patients. Aggressive tumors need aggressive therapy. Now, this comes from sub-analysis of trials, you know, like the Italian TRIBE study, etc. So there has never been a dedicated BRAF have V600E mutant triplet plus bevacizumab trial. So we kind of look at subgroup analysis. But I think there are three different separate subgroup analyses from trials, and they all suggest that, again, with a triplet combination, you can potentially counteract the negative biology of these BRAF V600E mutant tumors. And that has made inroads into NCCN, ESMO, and Japanese guidelines. Now, the question that we have, of course, is with data like Scott's trial, the SWOG study 1406, where you use the BRAF inhibitor plus an EGF receptor inhibitor plus an chemotherapy like irinotecan, or the interesting results of the Beacon study, which looked at MEK inhibition, BRAF inhibition, EGF receptor inhibition, so all biology, can those, let's say, biologic approaches be better than chemotherapy in first line, like FOLFOXIRI, bevacizumab? We don't know that yet. This trial is in planning, but we don't know that yet.
And actually, we did ask the audience whether they use targeted therapy in patients with BRAF mutant disease, and the vast majority do, and I think the most common answer was exactly what you were just talking about, the regimen of irinotecan with EGFR antibody vemurafenib. Can you talk about your clinical experience, both with efficacy, but particularly toxicity? You got some pretty dermatologic toxic issues here.
And that's the issue. I mean, you combine an EGF receptor inhibitor with a BRAF inhibitor, especially vemurafenib generates photosensitivity, which is one of the first generation BRAF inhibitors, which has fallen out of grace in the melanoma world, you know, so we're not using vemurafenib a lot anymore. So it gave vemurafenib a second life. It's probably not the best BRAF inhibitor there is. What I have more experience with is the combination, which was mentioned, the Beacon study, which is the EGF receptor inhibitor, cetuximab, then the BRAF inhibitor encorafenib, and binimetinib is a MEK inhibitor, which really tries to interfere with the biology of BRAF V600E mutant tumors. Now, the interesting thing is when you combine a MEK inhibitor and an EGF receptor inhibitor, you actually see decreased skin rash. You know, so the skin toxicity actually goes down because some of the skin rash was actually mediated by a paradox, a redundant pathway activation after EGF receptor blockade, and which can be then mitigated by a MEK inhibitor.
That's interesting. You mentioned the encorafenib and binimetinib, and I think I remember hearing that that maybe is a little better tolerated.
Yes, it is better tolerated. I mean, you still have the MEK inhibitory side effects, which is the retinal dysfunction. There's some kind of blurry vision for some time. There's also a MEK potential cardiotoxicity. But overall, binimetinib and encorafenib have shown to be very well tolerated. And it's one of the new regimens in melanoma, which then made it into the colorectal cancer world.
So another issue that we got into that you've been very involved with is later line therapy, and particularly the issue of regorafenib and TAS-102. And interesting, I guess you and Tony Saab presented these data in January. You started 80 milligrams. Can you talk about why you do that and the data that you presented earlier this year?
Yeah, so we had early data, of course, Mayo Clinic being the largest participant, the CORRECT study, you know, which led to the approval of regorafenib. What struck me in my patients, it was a blinded study, but it was easy to see who received regorafenib and who received placebo, because patients really within the first 2 weeks developed serious side effects, in particular hand-foot skin reaction, you know, the inflammatory reaction mainly affecting patients' feet with blisters and inability to walk, then profound fatigue, dysphonia. So patients really noticed their treatment. And what struck me, particularly with the skin reaction, was it is different than capecitabine. Capecitabine is something, you know, hand-foot syndrome, where we know, okay, the longer we treat, you know, the symptoms come over time, and it's not as severe. There's not this inflammatory response. Now, with regorafenib, the skin reaction, this hand-foot skin reaction comes very early on and really covers the first 2 weeks. And I was worried about, you know, patients starting with a full dose and then telling physicians, I can't tolerate this treatment within the first week, and then never having a chance to really see whether the drug works. Because if you only treat patients for a week, you'll never see whether this agent works. So in order to keep patients on the treatment, I thought it would be more important to start with a lower dose, really get you know, cover the first 1 or 2 weeks, start with half the dose, 80 milligrams instead of 120 per day, and then see how patients tolerate the dose with dose escalation week by week by week. And very importantly, really contact patients, really review with them toxicities on a weekly basis. This is something we did not do in the initial CORRECT study. Patients came back after 2 weeks. We left them alone for 2 weeks, and they came back with significant side effects, which really kind of led to, you know, a lot of toxicities that I personally saw in my patients. So the strategy of using 80 milligrams per day for the first week, then 120 milligrams, then 160 milligrams, came out of the observation early toxicities, and we need to touch base with the patient at least on a weekly basis to really talk about what's the optimal dose.
So another question we asked relates to the issue of sequencing of TAS-102 and regorafenib. How do you approach that decision, and do most of your patients end up getting both?
Yeah, so I do believe the pool of patients that is candidate for TAS-102 is larger than for regorafenib. I would not treat a patient with a reduced performance status PS2 with regorafenib, but I would see no problems treating these patients with TAS-102. Now, in a good performance status patient, PO0 and 1, my goal is to really expose these patients to all active agents. And so you have TAS and rego, you know, both there. And my concern is always if you start with TAS early on, which might be more tolerable for patients, they don't perceive, you know, the side effects as much as with regorafenib. But if tumors progress and patients deteriorate in their performance status while they're on TAS, they might not be candidates for regorafenib. So in a good performance status patient, I would talk to the patient, talk about side effects, make sure that they understand that regorafenib is not a cytotoxic agent, you know, I can not a chemotherapy agent, and that we use regorafenib first, followed by TAS-102 to really enhance the chance that they can be exposed to both active agents.
Let's talk a little bit about checkpoint inhibitors in colorectal cancer, mainly related to MSI-high disease. And one of the questions we asked the audience was, if you put aside regulatory and reimbursement issues, ideally, if you have a patient who's not symptomatic or minimally symptomatic and has MSI-high disease with metastatic disease, what line therapy would you use a PD-1 antibody? And actually, most of the audience said they would like to use it first line, and seems like you agreed. Do you ever do that?
Yeah, I have done that in a couple of patients, you know, where the insurance companies were actually willing to pay for that. Because it's not FDA approved this way. This would be off-label, and it's not even NCCN guidelines approved. I mean, in NCCN guidelines, we would look at second or third line treatment for patients with MSI-high mismatch repair deficient cancer. But you know, I've seen excellent responses in using pembrolizumab, for instance, a single agent in first-line therapy, durable, complete responses. So all this having said, you know, there are trials that are ongoing or have completed accrual. There's the KEYNOTE study 177, which compared pembrolizumab to standard of care chemotherapy in first line. And there is an intergroup study which looks at the addition of atezolizumab to standard chemotherapy or single agent atezolizumab as a PD-L1 antibody in first line treatment. So at some point we will know whether it's really better to use these agents in first-line treatment or in later lines of therapy.
Where are we today in terms of the data on the use of checkpoint inhibitors, and including the more recent data looking at ipi-nivo? But globally, where are we, first of all, with monotherapy in terms of numbers and response rate?
So when we look at pembrolizumab, nivolumab, the initial data that we saw a higher response rate for pembrolizumab compared to nivolumab. You know, pembro in the range of 50-60%, nivolumab in the range of 30%. But these were very small studies, very small studies. At ASCO recently, when you look at the more expanded experience on pembrolizumab, responses have come down to the 30-35% range. But this is response. There are a lot of patients who also have stable disease. So we're looking at progression-free survival, and there is actually a plateau in these patients with single-agent therapy, which could be in the range of about 25-30%. But if we add ipilimumab, you know, to nivolumab, we lift this plateau up by about 15-20%, which is really interesting. So I do believe at some point down the line, we'll move away from just single-agent PD-1 antibodies to combination and potentially even include chemotherapy, which I find intriguing based on the lung cancer data, you know, which really showed immunotherapy, antigen release, priming the immune system, and then taking the brakes off the immune system could actually be the right way to go.
Well, people want to get that checkpoint inhibitor in early anyhow because of the possibility of prolonged response.
Yes. And it could be different in MSI-high colon cancer, which is very immunogenic, compared to kind of lung cancer. It could be different from tumor to tumor. Our problem right now is the MSS tumors. You know, Johanna's trial, you know, the cobimetinib atezolizumab study really did not pay out. And compared to regorafenib, absolutely no different, not even a hint of a subgroup that could benefit.
What do you see in terms of PD-L1 and tumor mutation burden assays in MSI?
You know, it's a good question. I mean, we know that these cancers have very high mutational burden, and we just actually saw data presented that the different enzymes that are deficient, whether it's MLH1, MSH6, or PMS2, for instance, they are associated with differences in tumor mutational burden. So MSH6, for instance, mutation or deficiency have the highest tumor mutational burden, MLH1 lower tumor mutational burden. Now, we have not yet correlated this with outcome.
So you see a high tumor mutation burden in general with MSI-high disease?
Yes, yes. Very high tumor mutational burden.
That makes sense. But what about PD-1 levels?
They are loosely correlated, but when you do multivariate adjustment, PD-L1 in MSI-high tumors do not play a role anymore.
So as you mentioned, you do have these single-arm data sets that look exciting about Ipi-Nivo. Would you attempt to do that outside a trial setting? Could you imagine a situation where you might want to do that?
Yes, I could. I mean, the data, so far we have at Mayo Clinic particularly used a lot of pembrolizumab, but I see the nivolumab, ipilimumab data are pretty convincing, and they are recently published, so you have full publication to go back to. And I believe, you know, this is likely the future. If it was me, myself, I could see getting treated with ipilimumab and nivolumab, in particular, since ipi, because everyone's afraid of ipilimumab toxicities, it's only 4 doses at a low dose. So the toxicity is not as threatening as we might have thought initially.
Where are things heading right now in terms of MSI-high disease, and who should be tested for MSI?
I think every patient with a solid malignancy should be tested for mismatch repair deficiency. I mean, that's along the lines of the FDA approval. I mean, the FDA put some thinking to that, allowing pembrolizumab to be used for all patients, not even characterize which kind of cancers, but all patients with tumors harboring this specific phenotype. And so we have an FDA-approved agent that's looking for patients, and we can only identify these patients if we run the test. And if you look at immunohistochemistry, that's a pretty cheap and easy test to use for all solid tumors. So at Mayo, again, we have implemented at least all GI cancers should be checked, and we've left it up to the different disease groups to see whether, for instance, bladder cancer and others, or prostate cancer should be checked too. If I had a cancer, I would like to see what my mismatch repair deficiency status of my cancer was, because, you know, the implication for treatment, even if it's only 1 out of 200, would be tremendous.
So we got a couple questions from the audience about something I wasn't sure why they were asking, which is the issue of, quote, patient with MSI-high disease is also BRAF positive. Do we know anything about that specific subset, and particularly how they respond to checkpoint inhibitors?
Yeah. So about 15-20% of patients with BRAF mutation are also MSI high. And the biology is, you know, BRAF mutation leads to methylation, higher methylation of DNA, which can methylate the promoter region, particularly of MLH1, the MLH1 gene, which deactivates the gene. So what you have is a BRAF V600 mutation. You see lack of expression of MLH1 immunohistochemistry. And this is based to a kind of a methylation shutdown of the promoter region of this gene. So there is this overlap, but we have seen data in particular from Mike Overman's study that patients with BRAF mutant tumors and non-BRAF mutant tumors, Lynch syndrome and non-Lynch syndrome patients, they respond to immunotherapy in exactly the same way. So whether it's BRAF V600 mutant or not, the MSI high situation or mismatch repair deficient situation is really the most deciding phenotype for the use of immunotherapy.
So one final question about colorectal cancer. We spoke about the issue of cancer stemness inhibitor, napobucosin in particular, that's being studied both in colorectal and in gastric cancer. Can you talk about what we know and what this strategy is based on and what kind of clinical research data we have? Again, Johanna Bendel looked at FOLFIRI plus BEV with napobucosin. Where are we right now with this strategy?
So outside of immunotherapy, I think stemness inhibitors would be the most attractive treatment approaches if we embrace the idea that the tumor is comprised of stem cells and dedicated more committed cells, which are more susceptible to chemotherapy, whereas the stem cells are not very susceptible to chemotherapy, then it's really worthwhile embracing stem cell inhibitor research. Napobucosine, or BBI-608, the old name, is a STAT3 inhibitor, which interferes with Wnt signaling, one of the primordial pathways that can drive stem cells. So there is a lot of enthusiasm to finally have something that at least in vitro models and animal models inhibits tumors and tumor stem cells. But now we are trying to move this into humans. Now, the data that we have in humans are kind of a mixed bag of information. First of all, we had a Canadian study which looked at napobucosine in a later line setting compared to placebo. A lot of patients had side effects because the dose of the napobucosine was high and patients had a lot of diarrhea, did not really stay on the drug long enough to really see any effect. So the initial data of this phase 3 study in later line setting was negative. Now, there was a subgroup of patients with phospho-STAT expression levels, you know, the target expression levels, where there was a signal in terms of improvement in overall survival. Now, in gastric cancer, there was a registration study which looked at adding napobucosine to paclitaxel compared to paclitaxel, and the study was negative. So we have negative data in terms of gastric cancer, second-line therapy, overall survival. Now, we have Johanna's data, or actually data that are generated in multi-institution setting, where the combination of FOLFIRI with or without bevacizumab plus napobucosine actually generated quite interesting stable diseases responses, even in patients who had been pretreated with FOLFIRI with or without bevacizumab. So could it be that napobucosine kind of resensitizes tumors to chemotherapy or exploits a different mechanism of action? I don't know. The data are intriguing enough that we are actually running a phase 3 study in a second-line setting, the CANSTEM C303 study, international study, napobucosine added to FOLFIRI with or without bevacizumab. The study has accrued more than half its population, a target population of more than 1,000. So that's one of those old randomized phase 3 study designs, and hopefully we'll see data probably in a year and a half to see really whether napobucosine has effectiveness in colorectal cancer.
So let's move on now and talk about gastric cancer, which was discussed in the symposium by Charlie Fuchs and Yelena Janjigian. And one of the issues we were getting into there was sequencing of agents in metastatic disease, particularly second and third line therapy. And now that we have checkpoint inhibitors as an option, we asked people in general what their second line therapy was in HER2-negative gastric cancer after first line FOLFOX. Most people are saying ramucirumab paclitaxel, but about a quarter of the audience would test for a PD-L1 and consider pembrolizumab. How do you sort through that decision, Axel?
Yeah, it's an interesting point, and you rightfully said, you know, second, third line therapy is a wide open field, and I don't think we have this one standard of care. I think first line is pretty much locked into fluoroprim plus platinum, and then there's kind of the Wild West. You have randomized data for paclitaxel ramucirumab, which is probably the most established standard of care. And then checkpoint inhibitors come somewhere in there, and the nivolumab and pembrolizumab, the way they're being developed is a little bit different. Nivolumab tries to develop PD-L1 levels agnostic. They don't care about PD-L1, whereas for pembrolizumab studies, they check their reactive score, their PD-L1 score in immune cells and tumor cells, and only select those patients who are PD-L1 positive. Now, one interesting point was the KEYNOTE-61 study, which compared pembrolizumab to paclitaxel in second-line therapy. I mean, a lot of the studies we've seen in GI malignancies, whether it's HCC, whether it's gastric cancer or colorectal cancer, data that we've seen have been based on single-arm pembrolizumab, nivolumab, plus minus ipilimumab studies, but we didn't have a lot of randomized comparison. There's ATTRACTION-2, which compared nivolumab to best supportive care, so no active control arm. Now, KEYNOTE-61 was the first study in a GI malignant tumor which read out and compared pembrolizumab in PD-L1 positive tumors to paclitaxel, which is might not even be the standard of care, because as the audience said, paclitaxel plus ramucirumab was standard of care. And the study was negative. Negative for its primary endpoint, particular overall survival. But when you looked at the curve, there was an interesting crossing of the curves. There was a subgroup of patients that might have had long-term benefit from pembrolizumab over paclitaxel. And that's the intriguing part. By all hazard ratio and p-value definition, pembrolizumab did not beat paclitaxel, but there was a subgroup of patients that had long-term benefit. And I think our challenge right now is to identify these patients who have this long-term benefit.
It always strikes me as kind of weird when I see these big phase 3 trials comparing checkpoint inhibitors to chemotherapy. You see it in lung cancer and a bunch of other diseases. And I guess that's just an outgrowth of, you know, how drugs get approved and looked at, but it seems like maybe what you want to look at more is what the chance is of somebody being, you know, free of progression in 18 months or 2 years.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think what we need to change is our readout for regulatory approval. If I see, for instance, a drug that can keep patients free of progression for, let's say, 2 years, in about 20-25%, which is the tail of the curve, that is an active agent. We don't see that with chemotherapy. And I believe in looking at the tail of the curve and trying to develop strategies to raise the tail, which could even translate into cure. You know, I mean, if we have a tumor that doesn't progress after 2 to 3 years, that might be good. Something interesting that came up that Scott and I, you know, in our symposium with you talked about is we have both used pembrolizumab in a neoadjuvant fashion and had resected tissue after treatment, which still looked viable on scans, but was actually fibrosis. So sometimes what we see on the kind of residual cancer manifestation on long-term treated patients, you know, on scans, might actually not be cancer anymore, might be just fibrotic tissue.
So there was a question from the audience. Do patients do worse who get antibiotics and checkpoint inhibitors? And i.e., is there a correlation between the gut microflora and the response to checkpoint inhibitors?
So I don't know that, but there were very intriguing data actually coming from, including Charlie Fuchs' group, where they looked at something very cool, that bacteria that colonize the cancer, the primary tumor, can also be found in the metastasis from these cancers, Fusobacterium nucleatum. So, and there were preclinical data and kind of animal data where they actually looked at antibiotic treatment of animals that had the PDXs, the transplanted tumors, that harbored these bacteria. And these bacteria and the cancer responded to antibiotic therapy. So it could actually be a question of which antibiotic do we use for which bacterium. And I can envision that in the future, we might not just check the tumor genome, but also the bacterial genome that is embedded in the cancer.
That's fascinating. Someone said in the question about the combination of checkpoint inhibitors and chemotherapy. Is that being looked at in gastric cancer?
Yes, it is being looked at in gastric cancer. We don't have data yet.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, yes.
Also, in terms of other new things, we saw some data on TAS-102 in gastric cancer. What do we know about that?
Yeah, so TAS-102 actually had a phase 3 study, which was reported out to be positive. And I think we'll see data probably at ESMO this year. It's a phase 3 study in a later line setting. And, you know, it makes sense. I mean, TAS-102 is a fluoropyrimidine. It is not cross-resistant to 5-FU, which is one of the mainstays of gastric cancer therapy in combination with platinum agents or irinotecan, etc. So it does make sense that TAS-102 has some activity in a later line setting when you compare it to a placebo.
Interesting. How about regorafenib? There were some phase 2 data looking at that in gastric cancer.
Yeah, regorafenib also has activity based on phase 2 data, the INTEGRATE study, an Australian gastrointestinal tumor study group study, Australia plus Korea. They have very impressive data in terms of progression-free survival, and it's again being tested in a phase 3 study right now against best supportive care / placebo. You know, it gets crowded in this field. Now, when you look at, you have chemotherapy, standard chemotherapy that works, paclitaxel, irinotecan, ramucirumab, in addition to paclitaxel, you have checkpoint inhibitors, pembrolizumab, nivolumab, TAS-102, a cytotoxic agent, and regorafenib likely showing activity in a phase 3 study, the INTEGRATE 2 study. It's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out in terms of sequencing in the end.
So another agent that we talked about that's in development that looks pretty interesting is andacaliximib, a monoclonal antibody. Can you explain what that is and what we know about it?
That's the MMP9 inhibitor, which is kind of a revival of these matrix metalloproteinase inhibitors, because they were on vogue when I did my preclinical studies about 20 years ago, interfering with tumor host interaction. And there are some interesting data, which I would like to see confirmed in larger randomized studies. I'm a little bit skeptical because MMP9 inhibitors have been tried in various malignancies and in gastric cancer, colorectal cancer, pancreas cancer, and actually in breast cancer and lung cancer, and none of these studies was positive. Why would this antibody all of a sudden be positive? Or is it just a fluke? You know, because if you run 20 trials, one of them might actually have a p-value below 0.05.